I'm Kelly Schneider. I'm a GYN oncologist here in Charlotte, and I would like to introduce our speakers. We have Dr. Michael Buhr here. He is a vice chancellor at the University of Arkansas. He's the director of the cancer center there. And remotely, we have Dr. Medelonis. She is with Dana-Farber, and she will be joining us remotely. So our agenda today, we'll be talking about PARP inhibitors, antibody drug conjugates, endometrial cancer, followed by cervical cancer.
So before Ursula gets started reviewing PARP inhibitors in ovarian cancer, first, Ursula made a brave attempt to get there, but unfortunately the airlines didn't cooperate. Her flight is just taken off right now, and we couldn't find another flight for her, but thankfully we were able to loop her in here virtually. We got Mike there as well. So why don't we just jump right into it, Ursula? Of course, PARP inhibitors has been a huge issue the last few years in ovarian cancer. Last year's ASCO, we saw some new data. It was very interesting as well. Can you kind of bring us up to speed on where we are today?
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. I broke my leg a few weeks ago, and that's not what deterred me today. It was the airplane just not moving ahead. So there's a lot to talk about PARP inhibitors. A lot's happened over the past year, and I think more to come. But basically, the first question is, what type of genetic testing do we do for patients who are newly diagnosed? So how should we really approach the newly diagnosed patients? And then which patients should be offered PARP inhibitor maintenance therapy? And then how do we choose olaparib-bev, as well as niraparib? So what I do when a patient walks into me and she is either got an advanced GYN cancer, we haven't made the diagnosis yet, or she comes in with a diagnosis, I already have a set plan. So once that diagnosis is made of an ovarian cancer, mostly high-grade serous carcinoma, I will send her for germline testing, for panel testing. And I do that really almost immediately. It gives us a lot of information. It can tell her and her family, do they have a BRCA1 or 2 mutation or other mutation within the family? I usually, family members will come in, they're all nervous about, am I affected, yes or no? So we'll get that information pretty quickly. If there's adequate tissue on that initial IR-guided biopsy, if the patient's going to go to neoadjuvant chemotherapy first, I'll send that tissue for next-generation sequencing. So we've got the germline sequencing going, the somatic sequencing going, and then seeing if there's a BRCA1 or 2 mutation and thinking about PARP inhibition towards the future. If there's not adequate tissue and that patient's going to go to debulking surgery after neoadjuvant chemotherapy, that the tissue obtained at surgery can be used for the sequencing. The tissue tends to be more necrotic after chemotherapy. So sometimes the sequencing and also the HRD testing. So if a patient comes back BRCA wild type, so nothing in germline, nothing somatic testing, that's when I'll do HRD testing. And all that's getting done, and I'll explain that to patients up front while they're getting their carboplatin and paclitaxel chemotherapy. Who should be offered PARP inhibitor maintenance? This really hasn't changed too much. I think we're waiting for some important overall survival data from the PRIMA study, and then other trials, as I'll talk about before, adding in IO with PARP inhibition. But basically, for anyone who is BRCA mutated, so either has a BRCA 1 or 2 deleterious mutation, I will give that patient 2 years of olaparib post-chemotherapy. Really impressive 7-year overall survival data that was presented at ESMO in 2022. If the patient's on Bev, if you've opted to give that patient carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, then, and you say, well, I'm going to continue Bev, then through the PAOLA 1 study, I would add olaparib to bevacizumab. If the patient's BRCA wild type, but HRD positive, obviously have a discussion with the patient, but I definitely lean towards recommending PARP inhibition. And obviously SOLO-1, which only enroll patients with BRCA1 or 2 mutations 2 years apart. PARP inhibitor. The PRIMA study looked at 3 years of niraparib. So there's a difference there, 2 years of olaparib, 3 years of niraparib. Kind of have to try to rectify that. But certainly for HRD positive, BRCA negative, then the patient would consider niraparib. BRCA negative HRP, homologous recombination proficient. So she has a lower HRD score that comes back. I will counsel the patient, and in a lot of the situations, I think potentially not use a PARP inhibitor. But if she's got a great response to chemotherapy, maybe if her HRD score is closer to 42 but not really positive, then consider using niraparib. And then a lot of times comes up that the HRD test just doesn't come back. It comes back not able to be done. Then that's more difficult, and you kind of have to review the risks and the benefits with the patient. How do you choose among olaparib, olaparib bev, and niraparib? I kind of touched upon those a little bit before, but for solo one, you know, this is the data that was presented at ESMO, the 7-year overall survival data, and published in the JCO recently as well, showing a clinically significant trend towards an improvement in overall survival. The primary point here was progression-free survival. So it was powered for PFS, not for OS. For PRIMA, this tested 3 years of niraparib. PFS, very positive, and all the subsets, OS data, not available yet. For, again, when adding BEV, the PAOLA-1 trial, which now has final overall survival results. So on the left are patients with BRCA-mutated cancers. In the middle are HRD, and on the right are patients who have HRP, or homologous recombination proficient tumors. There are overall survival benefit trends towards patients with BRCA mutations and HRD, but on the right, you can see there's a poor overall survival trend for olaparib, BEV, and HRP patients, so there's no FDA approval for adding a PARP inhibitor to bevacizumab in the HRP setting, so patients should not be receiving this. Next question, what role, if any, do PARP inhibitors have in the management of relapsed ovarian cancer? What do you make of the recent withdrawal of various later line indications of PARP inhibitors? And do I ever re-challenge with a PARP inhibitor in patients who have experienced disease progression on or after PARP inhibition? So this is a table that talks about the changes. So the red boxes are what's changed in 2022. The other boxes have been very stable. So we've already talked about upfront management with single agent PARP inhibitors. So olaparib and niraparib have approvals. Rucaparib does not have an FDA approval for upfront maintenance with BEV. We talked about PAOLA-1. And adding olaparib to bevacizumab, niraparib nor rucaparib have FDA approvals in that setting. So getting to relapsed cancer, lots has changed. So I'm going to start all the way on the right for treatment for relapsed BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer. So this is where PARP inhibitors made their first entrance into how we treat ovarian cancer patients, and that was in 2014. And basically, what happened over 2022, our two trials reported poor overall survival trends. So nothing was statistically significant because these trials weren't powered for OS. For the use of a PARP inhibitor versus chemotherapy, so SOLO 3 and then ARIEL 4. ARIEL 4 is a trial that Amit Oza presented at ESMO 2022, and this was for patients all BRCA mutated, looking at either chemotherapy, so either weekly paclitaxel in patients with platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, or a platinum doublet or platinum in patients who are platinum-sensitive versus rucaparib. And in all three groups, platinum-resistant, partially platinum sensitive, fully platinum sensitive. Chemotherapy did better from an OS standpoint, but these are trends. This was not statistically significant. So rucaparib was rescinded because of this. Solo 3, which was also presented now at IGCS in 2022, was platinum sensitive relapsed ovarian cancer, looking at either olaparib versus non-platinum based chemotherapy for platinum sensitive disease. And chemotherapy showed an improved overall survival for patients who had received 3 lines or more of chemotherapy. And that's exactly where the initial FDA approval fit. So that was taken away as well. And these were the companies rescinded based upon FDA recommendations. Niraparib did not have a randomized trial, but had a single arm study looking at niraparib in either HRD positive or BRCA mutated heavily pretreated ovarian cancer patients, and that was taken away by GSK. For platinum sensitive relapse, using a PARP inhibitor as maintenance therapy, so the second column to the right, olaparib maintains its approval there. So you can still use olaparib either in patients with a BRCA mutated cancer or non-BRCA mutated. We don't, you know, we've really started using PARP inhibitors up front more, but there are occasional patients who never got tested, come back with platinum-sensitive disease, and are eligible. For niraparib and rucaparib, data presented over the course of 2022 showed that OS trends were poor, so were worse. These are trends, again, as I mentioned, for the PARP inhibitor versus placebo. So all the maintenance trials looked at the PARP inhibitor versus placebo. That was presented initially at SGO 2021 for niraparib, NOVA. That data will soon be updated. And then for rucaparib by Rob Coleman at the IGCS meetings for Aerial 3. So in both situations, in BRCA mutated is safe. So still, there's a OS trend that's positive, but for HRD positive BRCA wild type, and then HRP BRCA wild type, again, OS trends going in the wrong direction. I'm going to probably over my 6 minutes. The next question is around: do you ever rechallenge with a PARP inhibitor after a patient's experienced disease progression on or after prior PARP? And the answer is no. I've really changed my practice here a lot based upon all the data from the previous slide. The AREO study did look at PARP after PARP versus placebo, and there was an improvement in progression-free survival for both the BRCA-mutated as well as the BRCA wild-type patients, but it wasn't a particularly overwhelmingly positive PFS improvement. And I think now that we're learning about, are we potentially inducing treatment resistance with the use of a PARP inhibitor? And then something that I haven't mentioned, but certainly can, are the toxicity risks of AML and MDS, particularly in patients with germline BRCA mutations, where we see an up to 8% risk of AML-MDS based upon the SOLO 2 trial in the relapse platinum-sensitive setting in germline BRCA mutation carriers. And NOVA is just a little bit below that, around 7%. So again, corroborative data. So IA would not challenge with a PARP inhibitor for patients who cancers progressed on a PARP inhibitor. The only time I would potentially would be if somebody took a PARP inhibitor, stopped it early for toxicities or financial toxicities, or just didn't feel like taking it. But that would be a very unusual circumstance. So do I anticipate that PARP inhibitor immune checkpoint inhibitor combinations will eventually have a role in the treatment of advanced ovarian cancer? If so, how do you anticipate that these combinations will eventually be used? So these next two slides, I really pulled out studies that have tested combinations of PARP inhibitors plus immune checkpoint inhibitors, both in the platinum-sensitive recurrent setting, and that's this slide, and the next one talks about platinum-resistant setting. And I think you know, how this all came about really were through preclinical studies, through GEM models, showing that the STING pathway is activated, and you really do see more enhanced, potentially even synergistic activity with the use of an immune checkpoint inhibitor plus a PARP inhibitor. So I will point out, and I don't know if this slide shows. Yeah, it does. Okay, good. So in the Mediola study, which has been presented a number of times, looking at the combination of durvalumab, olaparib, and they also tested the triplet of durvalumab, olaparib, and bevacizumab in non-germline BRCA-mutated cancers. And you can see that the overall response rate was 34.4% for the doublet. The triplet was better, was 87.1%. And that response rate in the doublet, so I was asked about doublets, really is not particularly overwhelming. This is platinum-sensitive setting, so you'd expect, you know, chemotherapy response rates to be 50% or higher. Joyce Liu published GY004, which was looking at olaparib plus cedarinib, which is an oral VEGF receptor 1, 2, and 3 inhibitor, versus platinum-based chemotherapy in platinum-sensitive disease. And in the non-BRCA-mutated patients, we saw olaparib by itself having a 40% response rate. So this is not as impressive as I would have thought. In the JAVELIN PARP medley trial that was just published in JAM Oncology by Tim Yap a few weeks ago, talazoparib and avelumab were combined and showing a 20% response rate in non-GBRCA. So these are not, you know, I think they are all single agent trials, et cetera, but not particularly high response rates, especially in platinum sensitive disease. In the platinum-resistant recurrence, where we thought perhaps this would be a really potential strategy for treating our patients, the TEPASIO study, which was the first published by my colleague Panos Constantinopoulos a few years ago, looking at niraparib and pembrolizumab, there was an overall 18% response rate. And here, these were patients who were platinum-resistant recurrent disease, but they needed to have a response lasting at least 6 months to first-line platinum-based chemotherapy. So that really differentiates this population and maybe why there was a little bit of a higher response rate. The OPAL study presented by my colleague Joyce Liu looked at the triplet, niraparib, dostarlimab, and Bev in non-germline BRCA-mutated ovarian cancer, platinum resistant, showing about an 18%, which was okay, but again, a little bit lower than one would anticipate. And then the Moonstone study that was presented at ASCO last year by Leslie Randall was kind of the next step after TEPASIO, testing niraparib and pembro in non-GBRCA cancers up to 3 prior lines, only showing an overall response rate of 12%. So very comparable to non-platinum chemotherapy in that setting. So underwhelming results. Okay. So we're waiting for a number of phase 3 upfront treatment studies reading out the combinations of PARP inhibitors and immune checkpoint inhibitors. The Athena study that's looking at rucaparib and nivolumab. The Keylink 001 looking at pembro and olaparib. Looking at durvalumab and olaparib, and then the first study looking at niraparib plus dostarlimab. So I think the bottom line is, you know, so far, based upon phase 1-2 data, not overwhelming, but now we're going to move this into the upfront setting, and we'll see. So I certainly would not add immunotherapy together with a PARP inhibitor in the recurrence or in the upfront setting. We really need to see the results of these studies.
So Kelly, why don't we give Ursula a minute to rest her leg or broken leg? I don't know, Mike. You're going to tell me you got that skiing to work, right? I hear that from the people in Boston where Mike used to be. But Kelly, we'll go to you in a second with some questions. But first, a couple to you. Mike, first of all, in the chat room, Charles has a patient with advanced disease, abdomen, pleural fluid, who is BRCA negative, but BRAF V600E positive. So he wants to know about BRAF MEK, Mike. But before you even get to that, could you talk a little bit about how you think through the issue of neoadjuvant therapy or not BEV or not, and how that ties into your maintenance strategy?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's usually something we get sort of absorbed into systemic therapy discussions. We sort of gloss over a little bit the surgical approaches. Primary debulking was the surgical approach to ovarian cancer for years. And then basically four randomized studies showed that neoadjuvant therapy was just as effective as primary debulking. And as Ursula's pointed out, the interval debulking procedure, there's less blood loss, it's quicker, there's less tumor. Quite frankly, the surgeons like it. So in this country, we're now, I think we're over 50%, certainly where I am in Arkansas, we're using a lot of neoadjuvant to begin with. It does make some challenges, as Ursula pointed out, in terms of now we have all these biomarkers and genetics, you've got to move fairly expeditiously to get that information to your patient and to make your decision choices. BEV is almost, I think Ursula will laugh at this, but it's almost like a religious decision.
That's right.
It's historic. I was heavily involved in GOG 218, which is one of the randomized studies. ICON 7 was a European study. And so I happen to be a big BEV believer, but recognize that both of those studies showed somewhere between 2.5 to 4.5 month prolongation of PFS with no OS, change in OS. Now, at that time, we thought a hazard ratio of 0.7 was terrific. That's before the PARP ages, when our hazard ratios are now down to 0.3. But the bottom line is, there's no issue that it does increase response rate. There's no issue that it controls pleural effusions. It's great for ascites. So I'm a pretty big BEV believer. Probably 2/3 of my patients will start on BEV, unless there's a contraindication, brittle hypertension, maybe bowel involvement with tumor would not be a good indication to give BEV, because you do get some GI perforation. And then when the Apollo 1 trial came out showing that you could add a laparip to it, that really solved the problem, a conundrum that I had. Do I do BEV or do I do PARP? Now I can give both. The BEV use in this country is about 50%, which is up from what it was before, and I think that's partly because of Apollo 1.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that, Mike. I think with the realization that PARP inhibitors, and it's been a bit really eye-opening realization that PARP inhibitors have more limited, efficacy in or BRCA wild type cancers, I wouldn't be surprised if the use of BEV is going up, because maintenance is important for our patients to try to keep their cancer under control. So even if I'm seeing that there's an HRP tumor, I may add, or there's a sluggish response to chemotherapy, I certainly would think about adding bevacizumab as long as there's no contraindications in the upfront setting. I agree.
Kelly, any questions you want to bring up from the audience or that you have?
I do not have any from the audience. One of my questions is, what are you telling your patients that understandably have a significant fear of recurrence in the upfront setting when they get to the 2 to 3 year mark on their PARP inhibitor? Are you allowing them to continue? We have the first trial open where we are, and they're allowed to continue on the trial as long as the patients are well consented. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I'm not. I have a hard rule. Either they're on laparib for 2 years, and then even then IRAPRIB issues. I've thought more about this and really counsel patients once they've gone past 2 years. Is that the right thing to continue on for a third year? But I think as you see from the Solo 1 OS and PFS slides, is that once patients finish that 2 years, that separation of the curves continues. So especially with the AML MDS risk, potentially inducing treatment resistance, and I think also just the lack of data that continuing a PARP inhibitor beyond what's already been prescribed by the trials, I actually don't do it at all.
Could I add two quick points to that?
Mike, you had a question.
I'll make it quick. Of interest at Energy Oncology, there's a proposal for a randomized study to compare two years to 1 year maintenance. Because if you look at Solo 1 curve. It separates early on, and then it just parallels itself. So I think that's very interesting. I'll stop there.
That's a great point. Okay, so Ursula, I feel like we've already talked about a whole bunch of antibody drug conjugates today, but you have a couple of them here in ovarian cancer. Maybe kind of instead of kind of get into a lot of detail, but maybe provide more of a broad perspective of these two really fascinating agents.
Okay, absolutely. Neil, so mirvetuximab, given an accelerated FDA approval on November 14th, 2022, it is an antibody drug conjugate to folate receptor alpha, and DM4 is the target. And the bottom line is the SORAYA study outlined what is in the accelerated approval, platinum resistant recurrent ovarian cancer. So SORAYA tested high-grade serous only, but the FDA approval does not designate a specific histology. So it basically says platinum-resistant ovarian cancer up to three prior lines of treatment and must have an FR alpha positive test, and that is an IHC test. You can use archival tissue. Has to be FR alpha positive 75% or higher, 2 to 3+ staining. And the testing is now, and you can see on my slide, available through a number of different outside pathology showing. And this trial showed 32.4% response rate and median duration of response of 6.9 months. And these next few slides, again, show that the subset analyses are 1 to 2 or 3 prior lines, and then whether or not the patient had received a prior PARP inhibitor, and it didn't matter. You saw a very robust response rate, and the same is true if the patient does have a response, that median duration of response is close to 7 months, regardless of number of prior lines and then prior exposure to a PARP inhibitor. So definitely have incorporated this into my practice, got it through our P&T committee, and now we're testing using the outside labs, looking for the companion diagnostic for FR alpha positivity. As I said, the FDA approval doesn't designate histology. So if a patient with a clear cell cancer or carcinosarcoma ends up being folate receptor alpha positive, I am leaning towards giving that patient and trying this agent if appropriate. The nice thing about this drug is that besides the 32.4% response rate, 2/3 of the patients who had a response have that response by their first assessment. So, just before cycle 3, the remainder, most you can see from this, are at the second assessment. The adverse events are all, very nicely laid out in the package insert, plus also the JCO publication that came online a few weeks ago. The most significant side effects are ocular toxicities. They're all mostly low grade and reversible. There's some GI toxicities. There's no alopecia. And then the ocular toxicities, there's a black box warning on the package insert. It basically says patient has to undergo an eye exam prior to receiving mirvetuximab every 2 cycles, up to 8 cycles. So you can stop at 8. But also continue if clinically needed. Eye exam can be done by an optometrist or an ophthalmologist. And we're really looking for corneal changes, so corneal microcysts, and that's because of the DM4's effect on the corneal epithelium causing these corneal microcysts, which are seen on eye exam. The box on this paper, on this slide, is what the FDA has recommended as pre-medication. So there's about a 9% risk of an infusion reaction. So patients should get antihistamines and also some Tylenol, pre-med with an anti-nausea drug, and then with dexamethasone as well. Okay, and then the other is that recently in the NCCN guidelines in January 2023, mirvetuximab was placed on the preferred regimens for, just like the FDA approval is, FR alpha positive, so 75% or higher, 2 to 3+, platinum resistant up to 3 prior lines. And then based upon a paper that just came out in GynOnc looking at the combination of mirvetuximab plus bevacizumab that received a 2B designation. And that is for any cancer, any platinum-resistant ovarian cancer that has some folate receptor alpha positivity. And this is the paper by Dr. Gilbert. Dave O'Malley is the last author. And really, we see here is that for MIRV and bevacizumab together for platinum-resistant ovarian cancer is about a 44% confirmed response rate, median duration of response almost 10 months, median PFS 8.2 months, and efficacy of this combination was noted at lower levels of FR alpha expression. So, you know, even just up to 25%. And I said that led to the 2B designation on the NCCN guideline. Another antibody-drug conjugate that is being tested is upifitinib, risledotin, or UPFI. And that is an antibody-drug conjugate that is targeted towards NaPi2b. So the question was, based upon available data, do you anticipate that UPRI will eventually receive regulatory approval for the treatment of advanced recurrent ovarian cancer? And I really think it depends on the outcomes of several ongoing trials. UPRI, as I mentioned, targets ADC. The payload is auristatin FHPA, which is a proprietary DolaLock payload. Basically, the payload gets stuck in the cell, in the cancer cell, and there's not as much bystander effects or lower toxicities. Debbie Richardson at SGO last year presented phase one expansion cohorts looking at either the dose of 36 versus 43 milligrams per meter squared dosing. The 43 milligram per meter squared dosing had higher toxicities, had about a 15% rate of pneumonitis. The 36 milligrams per meter squared had about a 7% rate of grade 1 or 2 pneumonitis, so lower rates of pneumonitis, and that's the dose that's moving forward. There's efficacy data at that presentation on 25 patients who received 36 milligrams per meter squared. And in the NaPi2b high by IHC testing, the response rate was 44%. And then in all comers, that dropped to about 36%. And the duration of response, about 5 months. So these are the three trials that are ongoing. And will really tell us, is this drug going to move forward for regulatory approval? So the UPLIFT study is a extension of the phase one study. And this is looking at UPRI 36 milligrams per meter squared for every 4 weeks, platinum-resistant high-grade serous ovarian cancer, up to 4 lines of prior treatment. And looking at two populations, again, to try to determine, is the NaPi2b level of expression important to determine response rate and efficacy, or is it not? So 100 patients with NaPi2b high, 80 patients with lower levels of NaPi2b, primary endpoint, confirmed overall response rate. Again, taking the playbook from the mirvetuximab to see if an accelerated approval can come from this. Up next is the phase three study. And this is UPRI versus placebo, platinum-sensitive, recurrent, high-grade serous ovarian cancer, NaPi2b expression high, and you need to obviously have a response to platinum. This is being tested in maintenance. Maybe a little challenging just because you're looking at placebo versus UPRI. There's no BEV involved here, but that trial's ongoing. And then the third trial is UPGRADE, looking at combinations of UPRI and the first combinations with carboplatinum. And if multiple ADCs are approved, and that would be a great thing, how do we envision sequencing this drug? And I would certainly envision upfront testing, the taking patients now with recurrence and having to retrieve archival tissue, send it to labs, get the results back is really is painful because patients are waiting for treatment and now we've got to get the test results back and their cancer is progressing. So I would see that all cancers would be tested for all these different markers up front. And then, you know, newly need to determine if the marker changes between, you know, can you use archival tissue from upfront surgery or do we need to do tissue biopsies at recurrence? We know that FR alpha does not change. NaPi2b appears not to. And then just like, you know, Mike Beer was involved in the mirvetuximab studies from the beginning, you know, trying to determine biomarker expression levels, you know, how well does the drug work? You know, mirvetuximab took you know, years to develop because you're just learning along the way. And then if there are potentials for multiple use of drugs, you want to avoid overlapping toxicities that the patient already has, or maybe she's going to be at higher risk for developing neuropathy, myelosuppression, pneumonitis. And then we're going to need to understand resistance mechanisms to test sequencing. Can you use, you know, an anti-microtubule agent after an ADC that targets that is already shown resistance? And the same would be true for a topoisomerase inhibitor. There's a lot of work to do.
So before we get into endometrial and cervical cancer, a couple of questions for Mike, and then we'll go to Kelly, see if she has any thoughts or questions. So, Mike, I forgot to ask you before. I mentioned the fact that Charles in the chat room has this patient with ovarian and BRAF. Have you ever used Dabtrem? I mean, you do have a pan-tumor approval. Have you seen BRAF in ovary? And also, Mike, can you comment a little bit on quality of life issues with these two antibody-drug conjugates? You know, these antibody-drug conjugates in general in oncology, you're hearing all kinds of strange things. We just did an entire program with an ophthalmologist on ophthalmic issues in oncology. Of course, two-thirds of that was antibody-drug conjugates. So any experience with BRAF and ovary? And can you give us some more, like, you know, anecdotal, like, what's it like to be on these two antibody-drug conjugates from a quality of life point of view?
Yeah, so when you mentioned that before, what popped into my mind immediately was, are we sure that that's a high-grade serous or is it a low-grade? Because low-grades actually have a lot of BRAF mutations. The MEK pathway is activated. Those with BRAF, it was a study at Memorial, actually do very well. If they have a RAS mutation, which is another large group of low-grades, they do not do well. So I would recommend, first of all, it is targetable, you know that. But second of all, I would go back and carefully look at that from a histology standpoint, that he may be dealing with a low-grade tumor, which you need to know. And BRAF, those patients do reasonably well. They would certainly get chemo. They could get a little Bev. And at some point, they could get a BRAF inhibitor. In quality of life, yeah, this is a fascinating, I think, aspect of GYN cancers, because, you know, we spent years talking about neuropathy and years of myelosuppression because we had traditional chemotherapy agents. We've not been used to things that work differently, and that's true for the ADCs. Merv is a great story. As Ursula knows, I put a fair amount of patients on the original trials, and it was my patient who called up one morning after we had met as a team saying, hey, everybody's doing fine. She calls up and says, Dr. Beer, I'm blind. And of course, we all panicked thinking, you know, this is terrible, terrible stuff. It turned out it was blurred vision. But that is the toxicity. It's a keratitis. It's manageable, though. I argued for a long time, because it came up, that MIRV would be approved because that toxicity is very manageable. It's mostly grade 1 or 2, and you need to use lubricating eye drops and corticosteroid eye drops. It's prescribed, and if you ask women who are suffering from platinum-resistant disease, they have no problem as long as the drug is effective, and that drug is effective. I think NAPI is interesting. I'm very bullish on it, but what Ursula brings up is the pneumonitis, and the pneumonitis is something to keep our eye on. That's not trivial. I'm not quite sure where that's going to settle out yet, so we will need to follow more of that. And then finally, just again, anecdotal stories about my long experience in MIRV. I had a lady, platinum-resistant disease, 2 years on that drug, and she used to go and row on the Charles. I mean, the quality of life was just terrific. So I think they're here to stay. In fact, it'd be interesting to see what Ursula thinks, but I think MIRV and even NAPI, although NAPI's behind, will migrate to upfront treatment at some point, because everybody wants to get rid of the taxane. The taxane is the one that actually diminishes quality of life. They lose hair, they get a neuropathy. Don't like it.
Yeah. And Mike, that was your original idea. I remember you talked about that, you know, CarboMerv up front. And that trial is finally launched. But that's something that that you mentioned a number of years ago.
So actually, we've Kelly, got a couple of cases in the chat room of endometrial. But before we get to that, Kelly, any questions or thoughts you have?
Well, my question for everybody, now that MERV is available for everybody since November, although we all had a pretty significant issue with the actual assay testing for it, so we're just now being able to start to use it. Where does that fall for you in your treatment paradigm for a newly diagnosed platinum-resistant patient? Is that first line now?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, it depends upon the, you know, I mean, I think with the NCCN guidelines giving the 2B to MERV-BEV, that might expand that as another, yet another option besides just MERV-rituximab alone, depending upon the folate receptor alpha testing results. So, yeah, I think, you know, it depends upon the patient's toxicities that she has. You know, obviously, weekly paclitaxel with or without BEV is a very potent regimen, but it is a tough regimen as well with hair loss and neuropathy and weekly treatment. And I have a number of patients who responded, but they're I would say miserable with, you know, with nosebleeds and neuropathy and their nails coming off. So I think it's really a very, you know, good discussion to have with the patients about what, you know, what makes sense. I think the MERV data is there, and it's impressive, but obviously it has to be presented within the context of other agents and other toxicities that the patient, you know, doesn't want to involve herself with.
So why don't we
generally using second
okay.
line,
but after a Taxol Bev?
Yep.
Why don't we let Mike go ahead and talk a little bit about endometrial cancer. Before you do, though, Mike, in the chat room, Hassan has a 45-year-old woman with advanced endometrial cancer progressing after chemo-BEV, who's BRCA1 mutated. Any thoughts?
Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, well, I we don't generally think of PARP inhibitors for endometrial cancers, although there are a couple of trials that have been hypothesized and are trying to be designed. I guess my response would be, first of all, you'll see in my presentation, let's get the full testing. Has the patient had mismatch repair testing? Because that's going to be much more potent in terms of steering therapy. Do we know anything else about the molecular phenotypes? And that might raise the issue of an IO agent, which would be more effective. If you run out of options, using a PARP inhibitor may be reasonable. I don't honestly know, I've not tried it before, whether the insurance company would cover that. I don't know if you've done that, Ursula.
Yeah, we've done it in certain circumstances to try to get off-label use, and sometimes the patient would want to pay for it out of pocket if it's appropriate. But I agree. I think a PARP inhibitor trial would make more sense.
I mean, the one thing you got to remember is if you look at the PARP responses in ovary, breast, prostate, and pancreas for BRCA mutated patients, right? So they all have that abnormality. The response rates are dramatically different, right? Prostate and pancreas are nowhere near what they are in ovaries. So context does make a difference for these agents.
Yeah, I agree.
So Mike, if you can review some of the data related to endometrial cancer.
Yeah, we'll go through this fairly quick. So the question is, how are you incorporating anti-PD-1, PD-L1 antibodies in the management of microsatellite in unstable, high, mismatch repair deficient advanced endometrial cancer? How do you choose between pembro and dostarlimab for these patients? So if I leave you with nothing else today, but to make it very clear, as opposed to 5 or 10 years ago, when a patient develops recurrent endometrial cancer or metastatic endometrial cancer, there are real options for these patients. And I suspect the medical oncologists are going to be seeing more of these patients as we go forward, but I don't know that. But there's the field has really changed. And the reason it's changed is this, and I'm not going to belabor this, but you probably know, if you look on the left side, what you're seeing is the TCGA. This is a field that was driven by molecular discoveries, and then it got translated fairly rapidly into the clinic. And what you're seeing is that there are a number of groups of endometrial cancers. There are some that are mutated in POLE, that's polymerase epsilon. It's an editing polymerase. Those tumors are highly, highly mutated, 15 times mismatch repair tumors, which are 8 times, quote, normal endometrial cancers. So these tumors are loaded with mutations, and that's why those patients actually do quite well. Mismatch repair is on that left side also. They have a lot of mutations. And then we have what's called copy number low, I mean, well-behaved tumor. We're not quite sure what to do with those. And copy number high is your serous cancers. And you can see the survival in the middle curve with the POLE right on top. They just do extremely well because those tumors are on the edge of dying as they're just sitting there because they have so many mutations. And the final, the pie chart is important because it just tells you how many of the tumors are these each of these categories. POLE is fairly rare, but mismatch or MSI high is a big chunk of these tumors. And then CNV, which is a serous, good chunk, and CNV low is on the right side. This whole schema has been validated using a European set of tumors shown here. This is published in EMBO Molecular Medicine, which is a fairly high-level journal. They've named the groups a little differently. Mismatch repair is there, that's group 2. POLE is group 3, that's fine. But group 4 is non-specific molecular profile. That's the same as copy number low, the well-behaved tumors. We're not sure what to do with them. And group 1 is P53, that's mostly the serous tumors. So Keynote 158, keep it in your mind, it changed everything in this field. This was a basket trial of microsatellite unstable tumors across all the tumors. You can see the pie chart there. One of the biggest chunks was endometrial cancers, which was good for us. But there's cervix in here and there's even ovary. This is the waterfall plot that was followed up by Dave O'Malley, presented at a meeting and then published in Journal of Clinical Oncology last year. And the bottom line is there's a lot of water over those falls. I mean, this agent, Pembro, works extremely well in endometrial cancers that are microsatellite unstable. Most of these, many of them, are CRs. And this is Dave's follow-up data that he recently presented and also is published in that Journal of Clinical Oncology article, simply showing 4-year follow-up, both for PFS and OS. And I would argue, never seen anything like this for metastatic endometrial or recurrent endometrial cancer. Two is that although there's heavy censoring, obviously, on the right sides of those curves are not a curve, they're flat. And we're beginning to think in the field that some of these MSI high metastatic or recurrent endometrial cancers, these patients may be cured. So what's the role of IO in endometrial cancer? All patients with advanced stage disease should have MMR testing. What do I mean by that? Because there's confusion here. MMR testing is usually IHC for MLH1, MLH2, MSH6, and PMS2. These are the mismatch repair proteins. Okay, and that is usually done locally in a pathology suite, but it can be done centrally also. Foundation Medicine, other companies will run this. Mismatch repair testing can also look directly at the microsatellites using 5 microsatellites that have been nationally decided are reflective of this process, and they can be scored high or low. That was actually determined almost 15 or 20 years ago now. We've gotten away from that testing because it's a little more complicated. Recurrent metastatic disease, IO for MSI high or DMMR, that's what comes out of the MMR testing, which is MSI high, is category 1 now with NCCN 2023, just came off hot off the presses. I will point out that Phase 3 Energy GY018 Pembro chemo improves the PFS regardless of the status in stage 3 or 4 recurrent disease. And I'll bring to your attention, remember the Ruby trial. The company declared in December it met its primary goal, and we'll see that data this spring. What the Ruby trial did was take IO, combine it with chemo, so it's moving it up front in these patients. So it's likely, to, in my view, for this subset of patients, IO will be coming up front. Now, I can't leave this topic without talking about the Garnet trial because it is an important trial. It's also an anti-PD-1 therapy. It's dostarlimab. And it was done in recurrent metastatic endometrial cancer, single-arm phase 1 with expansion cohorts, and they had large numbers of both DMMR and MMRP patients. And you can see the waterfall plot. On top is the defective mismatch repair patients and their tumors. And you can see that waterfall plot looks a lot like what I showed you, 158. And the lower one is the mismatch repair proficient. One of the arguments when the Garnet trial first started was that this particular anti-PD-1 may work on tumors even if they're not defective. I think they've backed away from that. The response rate was originally 19%. Now it's down below 15%. I don't think these agents work well in proficient tumors. So which one do you use? I call it, frankly, and I think the companies aren't going to like this, but it's dealer's choice. Pembro has been in the longest in clinical use, but in fact, the dostarlimab was the only one that was actually tested on the Q6-week regimen. Pembro got the approval, but it was just based on PK issues. Both are used in many tumors, high affinity for target. I can't distinguish them. As I said, dosing it now 6 weeks for both. Typical autoimmune toxicities. And right now, the NCCN guidelines is category 1, first line for Pembro, second line for dostarlimab, but I think that's going to change with Ruby. Okay, second question, how are you incorporating Pembro-lovatinib into the management of microsatellite stable advanced endometrial cancer? So remember I showed you that map, about 30% were defective, but you've got all these other ones which are microsatellite stable. And this is just a spectacular story where the investigators combined lovatinib, which is kind of a dirty TKI, with Pembro in a trial of these patients with microsatellite stable tumors. Here's the waterfall plot. Again, lots of water over that waterfall. And I will also point out to you that if you go below 30%, you see that big chunk of patients in the middle. Those patients are not getting a response, but they're still benefiting clinically. The clinical benefit rate of this regimen pushes 75%. And then this is the KEYNOTE-775, which is the confirmatory study to that trial. And I'm not going to show it all, but I'll just show you that in the proficient MMR populations on the top, this is a direct comparison of len-pen compared to standard of care chemo. So the other arm is getting chemo. I don't need to be a statistician to tell you there's a pretty large difference between those. And these are alive patients. This is OS. And if you look at the all-comer population, the hazard ratio is a little bit better because there were a few mismatch repair deficient patients in this trial. So what's the role of lovatinib and Pembro in endometrial cancer? It's really standard of care now for recurrent metastatic endometrial MMRP patients, category 1 NCCN. The response rates I've already talked to you about. And please remember, for KEYNOTE-775, not only is there a PFS difference, there's an OS difference. These patients are living longer. Okay, how do you monitor for and manage common adverse events associated with pembrolizumab in endometrial cancer? How do you approach the initial dosing? This is important because here's the toxicity profile for 775. About 95% of patients, maybe even higher than that, will suffer toxicity of some grade on both arms. But if you look at the lovatinib Pembro arm, you have your typical thyroid problems, which is the Pembro, arthralgias with the Pembro, but you've got diarrhea, nausea, hypertension, decreased appetite, vomiting, fatigue. These are all from the lovatinib. And if you look further down, you'll see that About 40% discontinued due to treatment expected, the AEs. About two-thirds of those are from Len, about a third are from Pembro. So it's a regimen that works. You got to be careful with it. So how do I handle it? Right here. How does one manage lenvatinib-pembro dosing and toxicity? The starting dose on that trial was 20 milligrams. I'm a purist. I started 20. You should know, though, that the final average dose for Len was 14. I have a lot of colleagues who started 14. I started 20, but I'm very aggressive in terms of monitoring and dose reducing. And that's in the final bullet point. What are you expecting to see? Hypertension occurs, and you do not be confused that this is like bevacizumab. It's not. It's a TKI. It happens within 3 days. And it can be fairly impressive. So a lot of my colleagues will give out antihypertensives right at the time that they start the patient on. They'll give them a script at least so that if they have a problem, they can fill it. Diarrhea is usually lower grade, manageable. Fatigue is difficult. There's no issue about that. Remember the importance of NPs and their regular communication with the patient. Our patients will go out on Len/Pan. They will be called every day for the first week to make sure that we don't get into trouble on this thing. What do you make of the recently presented findings up front maintenance selinexor for patients with metastatic endometrial cancer? Are there currently any situations in which you use this strategy outside of a clinical trial? So you heard a little bit about selinexor. I just have this cartoon. It is an inhibitor of XPO1, which is involved in nuclear export. The theory here is proteins are made in cytoplasm. They get into the nucleus, including tumor suppressor genes. And if they're functioning normally and you block their escape from the nucleus, they'll pile up and then you'll get tumor apoptosis. Data in endometrial cancer actually supports that, and I'll show it to you right now. And this is a summary of the data I'll show you. Selinexor prolonged progression-free survival compared to placebo in patients with advanced and recurrent endometrial cancer. An exploratory subgroup is really interesting. Showed that those endometrial cancers with wild-type P53, that predicted for efficacy in a fairly dramatic way. That was seen no matter what the tumor was, whether it was microsatellite stable or copy number low. So this is the trial. Phase 3 trial, and selinexor here is being used as maintenance after standard chemo. And they had to have responded to that chemo, then they would be randomized placebo versus selinexor. This is the PFS, in intent to treat population, and you can see the blue curve on top is selinexor maintenance versus placebo. And this is the subset analysis that I think is kind of interesting. If you look at the left, it's P53 wild type. Those curves are very widely spread, again, potentially supporting this theory. This is exploratory, though. And if you look at the mutant P53, it has no effect. So we may have found a potential agent to treat those mutated P53 group that up until now we've had nothing to offer them. Remember, they are not mismatch repair deficient.
So we're running a little bit over here. I'm going to go to Kelly in a second to close this out. But a really interesting case in the chat room, Ursula, just to sort of finish out here. We're not going to go through cervical, but you can check out the slides in the slide deck. But this sounds like a real situation where they could use some input, Ursula. Lulu has a patient with Lynch syndrome, metastatic endometrial cancer, who progressed on Pembro. Then apparently she added lenvatinib and now it's progressing also. I'm curious, first of all, do you do that strategy, Ursula, and people don't respond? Do you ever start Pembro or lenvatinib, you know, up front? And any suggestions to Lulu?
Yeah, no, that's a good case. I usually don't. As Mike really clearly said, if the patient's got an MSI high tumor, mismatch repair deficient cancer, so I think single agent IO, if it's mismatch repair proficient, you know, you saw the, 775 data, which is very impressive. What I would probably do is sort of, it would be good to understand the histology. So this is because Lynch tumors can be different histologies. Look at the estrogen receptor status, any other, mutations or genomic aberrations from sequencing to kind of help determine next steps. Chemotherapy, obviously, there's carboplatin, paclitaxel, single agent liposomal doxorubicin, single agent Bev. So I would take a look at the molecular markers a little bit. If she's estrogen receptor positive, there are a number of trials looking at CDK4/6 inhibitors. If she's got a serous cancer, there are WEE1 inhibitors. So there are different other agents that are being used to target not only histology, but also different molecular aberrations.
So, Mike, any comments? The GI people, looked into ipi/nivo and MSI-high. You ever do that in endometrial?
Yeah, I 775 and 158 were so impressive. I don't usually think about other combinations because we generally get a response. I'm really surprised this Lynch syndrome patient didn't have a response. I would consider, and this is a little out of the box, but consider a combination IO trial for that patient. I still think they would respond. I think you'll see that, Neil, in the near future, as we do have some patients who progress through anti-PD-1, and so other combinations like ipi/nivo will come into a practice. I would love to see it tested, though, in a trial, and I would probably put patients on who have already been exposed to anti-PD-1.
Any final questions from you, Kelly?
A question that I was starting to wonder now that we know that, or we have indication that Ruby is probably going to be positive. What are your thoughts on a patient that is now on upfront IO as maintenance that eventually progresses? Because our natural next step is Lenvima Keytruda. So how do you feel about going from one immunotherapy to another one, or even if you're on the same one, adding in Lenvima, or is this changing our second line?
First of all, a lot of it depends upon the patient. So if it's a patient who gets their X years of Pembro and then they have a disease-free interval and then recur, that patient's going to be different than the one that just grows through Pembro. And I would fully admit we don't know the mechanism of resistance for any of them. I'd love to see, and I think we will when we have enough of these patients, see a series of clinical trials for previous exposure to anti-PD-1 using combinations of IO. And again, Neil was trying to sort of get at this, which CDL4, is that going to be a relevant target? I don't honestly know that, but it's pretty reasonable. Lenvatinib could be another choice.
So a flash update from the chat room from Lulu, who says she appreciates all the input from the experts, but she forgot to mention that it's clear cell, and that she's thinking about trying double immunotherapy next. So, Mike, clear cell, more sensitive to IO?
First of all, we need to extrapolate. Clear cells in endometrial cancer are pretty rare. We have to sort of extrapolate a little bit to ovary. There was Japanese data that suggested they were more sensitive to IO, but when that trial finally finished, I don't think it held up. And I think most of us sort of feel that they're relatively resistant to a lot of things. I don't think that would guide me in terms of treatment. Anti-angiogenesis might be a good choice.
Right. And a lot of the clear cells will have ARID1A mutations, and there are a lot of new drugs that are, targeting ARID1A mutations. So again, very reasonable to do sequencing on that patient. So
yeah, and I would probably add in there HER2 expression would be interesting.
Absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely, yeah, good, Mike. Yep, good idea.
So I think we better take a quick break. Thank you so much.